like a maestro with a symphony. Krennic, who had focused the energies of a million scientists and engineers and strategists and laborers into a singular creation. And this, all the while playing the games of the Emperor's ruling council, all while assuaging the petty jealousies of admirals and joint chiefs. Orson Krennic had built the Death Star, the greatest technological achievement in galactic history, a feat of engineering that rivaled the transformation of the city world of Coruscant or the invention of the hyperdrive. His achievement as much as anyone's. If that extraordinary and all-consuming venture had left him vulnerable, it was no failing on his part. Instead, responsibility for his circumstances rested squarely on one man, the very man who had summoned him to meet aboard the Star Destroyer, Executrix. Grand Moff Willef Tarkin was Krennic's true bane. While Krennic created, Tarkin fought to keep Krennic from rising above his station, from earning the attention of the Emperor himself. The old governor's back was to Krennic as Krennic strode onto the Executrix's bridge. Behind Krennic came an escort of his personal troops, an intimidation tactic lost on Tarkin as he stared out of viewport toward the massive Death Star battle station. Today, the firing array of the station's primary weapon was scheduled to dock. 6,000 detachable thrusters were maneuvering the colossal dish above the spherical superstructure of the station, where droids, technicians, and mechanical arrays awaited. Once the dish descended, they would lock it permanently into place. The operation had taken months of planning and required the shutdown of many of the Death Star's power systems to eliminate any risk of an energy surge. Krennic should have been there, sealed in a full environment suit in the temporarily airless corridors of the battle station, to supervise and observe the final stages. "Most unfortunate about the security breach on Jeddah, Director Krennic," Tarkin said, and turned his frail body around at last. He gave Krennic's death trooper escort not a glance, and reserved his most withering look for the hem of Krennic's white cloak.
"I'm afraid I'm not sure what you're referring to,"
Krennic lied, with a quizzical expression.
"You think I'm a fool, Tarkin?" he wanted to say. "You believe I don't have my own people within your ranks telling me everything they tell you?"
But if Tarkin thought him a fool, best to play the part. The governor kept speaking.
"After so many setbacks and delays, and now this. We've heard word of rumor circulating through the city. Apparently you've lost a rather talkative cargo pilot."
"And what does a cargo pilot know that's of consequence to us?"
Krennic asked, as lightly as he could.
"You acknowledged yourself that secrecy was becoming an impediment to progress some time ago. Rumors were bound to spread."
"The rumors are not the concern. The concern is proof. If the Senate gets wind of our project..."
Tarkin spoke with distilled contempt.
"Countless systems will flock to the rebellion."
Krennic countered instinctively.
"When the battle station is finished, Governor Tarkin, the Senate will be of little concern."
Tarkin's lips looked as chiseled as a crevice in a cliff, and just as good-humored.
"When has become now, Director Krennic. The Emperor will tolerate no further delay. You have made time an ally of the rebellion." "As if you speak with the Emperor's voice."
"I suggest," Tarkin said, "we solve both problems simultaneously with an immediate test of the weapon. Failure will find you explaining why to a far less patient audience."
Krennic was taken aback. It was not the way the conversation should have gone. An immediate test. Look for the trap. Tarkin demands nothing that doesn't serve him. But the old governor was waiting for an answer.
If Krennic appeared less than confident in the Death Star's capabilities, then that too would be turned against him.
I will not fail, he said. A test of the weapon to wipe Jeddah clean.
In a better world, he would have been able to say such a thing with triumph and anticipation. To see the battle station fully functional would be a glorious thing, and Tarkin had found a way to poison it.
Tarkin turned away in dismissal and disinterest.
Later, back aboard the Death Star, Krennic stalked through the voluminous corridors that honeycombed the massive station, inspecting the results of the day's work. The black floors were polished to a mirror sheen, and the reflection of Krennic's white uniform shone like a guiding beacon. Though he made a show of interrogating engineers and droids, of personally scanning conduits for microfractures, he knew there was nothing meaningful he might discover that wouldn't appear in the daily activity reports. He walked because it helped him focus, because vigorous exercise gave him an outlet for his frustrations. His meeting aboard the Executrix raised too many questions, and he analyzed and clarified circumstances and stakes with every harried step.
Lay it out as you would for a new development team. Solve the problem.
Did Tarkin believe the Death Star was not ready to be tested? That the primary weapon would fail? Revealing the Death Star as impotent above Jeddah carried substantial risk. It would be humiliating, as much for Tarkin as for Krennic. Yet Krennic had heard rumors that the Emperor's right hand, Darth Vader himself, kept Tarkin as a close ally. Was it conceivable Tarkin sought to use Vader as a shield?
A bold man, Tarkin. Bold and arrogant enough to orchestrate a public failure and deflect responsibility. Which raised another question. Why did Tarkin believe the test would fail at all?
He had long belittled Krennic's own ability, mocked Krennic's every recitation of the engineering challenges before them. So perhaps his disdain had blinded him to success. But to build a risky plan on an ungrounded assumption seemed unwise, even for Tarkin. Was it mere coincidence that Tarkin had summoned Krennic while the firing array was being placed? Would Tarkin go so far as to sabotage the installation? Krennic halted in his walk, spun about, and made for the outer decks where the firing array had been locked into place. His pulse quickened and his blood burned with ire. He commandeered a maintenance turbo lift and dismissed its occupants with a gesture. Only when he had arrived at the force field blocking a still airless corridor did he begin to calm. Behind the shimmering field stood two stormtroopers, equipped with oxygen tanks, as vigilant as ever. There were 100 other entry points to the construction areas that a saboteur might take, of course. Even the stormtroopers might have been in Tarkin's employ. But the scene was tranquil enough to drain Krennic's rage. Sabotage. The possibility galled him, yet he could adjust. He would reach out to his contacts within Tarkin's inner circle, learn what, if anything, they knew. Meanwhile, he had a day, perhaps two, until the evacuation of Imperial assets from Jeddah was complete. In that time, he could order every diagnostic imaginable for every focusing lens and kyber crystal and conduit in the firing array. If there was sabotage, his people would find it. Nothing aboard the Death Star could be hidden from Krennic. He alone, or at most he and one other, could comprehend its magnificence as a work of mortal invention. With those thoughts to comfort him, Orson Krennic finished his walkthrough and returned to his sparely elegant quarters, his home more than any planet or moon. He sat at his desk and drank wine and distributed orders and read his reports. His confidence was renewed, The Death Star would soon be complete, every last toggle operational and every hull plate ground smooth. The test on Jedha would be a triumph rather than a failure, and he would see the galaxy respond in awe and terror. No one, certainly not Willith Tarkin, would deny Krennic that pleasure.
In her dream, Jin was 5 years old, or maybe 4, or maybe 6. It was long ago, and she lay in the most comfortable bed she would ever know in her life. She clutched Beanie, her favorite toy, her best friend, against her face, so close that Beanie's fur was damp with Jin's breath. She held Beanie tight, and she listened.
Whatever atrocities they seek to commit, they have no movement, no organization. That's the upside of having anarchists as an enemy.
Jin didn't understand the words. She didn't like that. Sometimes it was nice, lying in the dark. She wasn't afraid of the dark at all, listening to the grown-ups talk. But tonight wasn't nice. They were talking about fighting.
Even the Separatists wanted more than just destruction.
Mama's voice.
And if they're so far gone, how is building a shining new empire going to win them over? We're talking about a very delicate time in our history.
The first voice again. Jin rolled over, peering through the door at the gathering in the living room. Mama in her pretty cloak, Pop in his gray uniform, and Papa's friend in white. They were gathered around the dessert table, and the man in white was pouring a drink, offering to refill glasses as he spoke.
If people believe in the Empire, military victory over Separatist holdouts and malcontents is inevitable. If people lose faith...
Mama was trying to interrupt him. The man waved her off. Well, you know about Malpass.
Coruscant will be fine, of course, but we'll all feel guilty enjoying these meals while terrorism flourishes in the Outer Rim.
Mama laughed, not a real laugh, but the quiet sort of laugh she used when she was supposed to laugh but didn't really want to. Papa looked over at Jin's bedroom, at Jin, and she saw that he knew she was watching. Mama was talking again as Papa stood and walked toward Jin. Jin drew her knees up, shrank back into her bed, as if she could hide. She didn't want Papa to shut the door. Not because she was afraid of the dark. She wasn't afraid of the dark. But because she wanted to keep listening. She deserved to keep listening. Papa didn't close the door. Instead, he stepped inside and sat beside Jin on her bed. She felt the mattress sink under her.
"What's the matter, Jin? You look frightened,"
he said, and pushed back a strand of her hair. He smelled like his uniform, sour and scrubbed clean.
"I'll always protect you,"
he murmured. Then the dream changed. Papa's body looming over Jin was no more than a shadow. Jin was alone in a cave, slamming a hatch shut, trapping herself in the dark. Mama was a corpse in the dirt by the farmhouse, and Jin had nothing. Even her song wouldn't emerge from her lips. She couldn't speak, and her lungs were full of smoke and ash and soil.
"Why do people fight?"
she asked, as she was back in her bedroom again, the horrors of her future forgotten. Papa took a long time to answer. When he finally spoke, he spoke as if he were thinking about it for the first time.
"That's a good question," he said. "My friend Orson says some people just fight because they're angry. But I think..."
He stopped talking and half closed his eyes. The voices in the other room continued.
"I think, usually, people are unhappy, and they don't agree how to make things better."
Jin watched her father try to tell what he thought of that idea.
"Maybe they'd agree if they'd stopped fighting first."
Papa looked at her kindly. Jin thought she'd surprised him in a good way.
"Stardust," don't ever change.
He leaned in to kiss her on the forehead. She wrapped her arms around him, felt his smooth and sour-smelling uniform press against her.
I won't,
she promised, then softer.
I love you, Papa. You're a good man.
Papa returned the hug, in her bedroom in the city and in her bedroom on Lamu. Both at once. With her chin on his shoulder, Jin looked past her father to her bedroom door. Mama stood in the living room watching them. She smiled very gently. Behind her stood the man in white. The arms around Jin's shoulders became thin and rough like string. Now Mama was right in front of her, putting her crystal necklace around Jin's neck. The hatch opened and saw Guerrera looked down. When Jin woke up, she was no longer a child, and she was no longer in a comfortable bed in an apartment on Coruscant. Her mother and father and Beanie were long gone. Beanie had been the first casualty of a private war, never making it as far as Lamu. The hatch, she knew, was irreparably broken. The U-wing trembled as Jin, in the dark of the ship's cabin, fumbled to find her mother's crystal necklace against her breast.
Supplemental data. Battle Station DS-1.
Document number YT-5368. Official statement on Battle Station DS-1 General Directive. Time-stamped approximately 2 years prior to Operation Fracture. Sent from the office of Grand Moff Willof Tarkin.
To Director Krennic. I find these communiques distasteful, but since you evidently require written reminders of your duty, I will oblige. It is incumbent upon everyone involved in the construction of the battle station, of clearance level DS-30 and above, to share a unified vision for the technologies involved, and in turn, our doctrine of use. The time for painstaking compartmentalization of development cells is past. Lying to your engineering teams about our ultimate goal let you recruit energy researchers and materials experts more interested in revitalizing Coruscanti infrastructure than in building a weapon. For this I give you credit. But we are building a weapon. One with a specific purpose that must not be compromised. Quite simply, it's time to stop playing games. The project of this scope has never before been attempted. I do not care what motivates your engineers, but it is imperative that they comprehend our priorities. In a battle station with 8 billion component parts, even a handful of poor decisions could compromise our ultimate effectiveness. Shall I elaborate? I shouldn't have to, but to wit. The battle station is not a military force unto itself. It is part of a system, and individual elements must be manufactured to Imperial standard. If there are incompatibilities with the Star Destroyer fleet, these must be remedied. The battle station is not a testbed for new technologies. Promising your people opportunities for innovation was a mistake. Update only when necessary. And if we must add 100 reliable, proven reactors, instead of developing a single new one, so be it. The battle station is certainly not symbolic, meant only to demonstrate the Empire's might in ceremonial planetary executions. The main weapon must be built to fire repeatedly within a short span, as it might during the course of a single fleet battle. Both the mechanisms and the control scheme must support this practice. We are building a weapon not to prevent a war, but to end one. Time and again we have seen the galaxy dissolve into instability and chaos. And the rise of the rebel terrorist movement is only the latest iteration of a cycle. The rebels have no chance of overthrowing us, but they threaten our order nonetheless. The Death Star will not put an end to treason. Yet never again will a conflict consume our galaxy as did the Clone Wars. When an enemy rises, we will strike with decapitating vehemence. If one strike does not suffice, we will repeat the process and burn planets until either our enemy is annihilated or the galaxy is so terrified that further resistance is unthinkable. The new peace will last until the cycle begins again, at which point the battle station will be redeployed. The interruption of stability will be brief and illuminating. Are we of like minds now, Director? The Death Star is the ultimate weapon of war. It serves no other purpose. It is not a monument to your workers' scientific prowess or the cornerstone of a new navy designed to your personal ideal. Crude but functional is an acceptable watchword. See to your stuff immediately. Document number YT5368A. Reply to official statement on Battle Station DS1 General Directive. Sent from the office of Orson Krennic, Advanced Weapons Research Director.
Respectfully, Governor, I request clarity. My understanding is that the battle station project was initiated at a level above either of us. I know you have the ear of the Emperor. Can you confirm that the vision you've elaborated comes directly from him? I would hate to see anything spawned from his mind, described as crude but functional. Indeed, I endeavor to exceed his expectations.
No follow-up documents found. Chapter 4. If Jedha had ever been more than a barren rock of a moon, some years or centuries past, Jin couldn't see it now. There was nothing to see from space. No great oceans. No churning clouds. No glittering cities of metal and glass that spread across continents like mold. Only amber dust and cold desert.
That's Jedha, Cassian announced. What's left of it anyway?
Winds tore at the U-wing as it breached the atmosphere, rocking the vessel and causing Jin to sway in the cockpit doorway. It was enough to leave her nauseated. Cassian and the droid seemed unperturbed, and she retreated to the cabin for the landing. Unwanted images of Saw Gerrera, Galen Erso, my father is alive, my father is a bastard, crept into her mind, spilling out of the hatch and crawling behind her eyes like parasites. She couldn't afford to sit and think. She'd go mad. Ignore the nausea and do something useful, she told herself. By the time the transporter lit on a cracked desert mesa, Jin had already sorted through everything she might need on the moon's surface. Thermal layering, gloves and jacket and hood, to ward off the chill, a pair of combat truncheons for close quarters fights, a satchel full of codebreakers and ration packs and maps, because she'd found them on the U-wing and she had an empty satchel to fill. While Cassian and K2SO were still in the cockpit, she left the ship and found a seat on a boulder like an icy knife. From there, she looked onto the valley and toward the distant walls of the city. The holy city. Jedha City. Ni Jedha. Depending on whose databank you checked. Dust and smoke obscured dully painted spires and palisades. Ancient stone plazas and gold-topped manors. From so far away, the settlement looked like a smudged painting of a history Jin didn't recognize. All she could make out with certainty were the shuttlecraft drifting like flies near the belly of an Imperial Star Destroyer hovering overhead. Where the city was rough and decayed, the destroyer was sleek and impermeable. Cassian and the droid emerged from the U-wing behind her. sending small pebbles tumbling down the side of the mesa.
What's with the destroyer?
She asked.
The Empire's been sending those since Saw Gerrera started attacking their cargo shipments.
Cassian said.
That didn't surprise Jin. You don't stop Saw Gerrera with a few extra TIE fighters. She wondered if she was proud or simply resigned to Saw's doggedness.
What are they bringing in?
She asked.
It's what are they taking out?
Cassian passed a set of quadnocks to Jin. She raised them to her eyes, scanned the horizon, let the automatic tracking systems fix and zoom in on one of the shuttlecraft. She saw half a dozen cargo crates colored hazard orange strapped to the undercarriage, but she didn't spot any markings.
Kyber crystal.
Cassian went on.
All they can get. We believe the Empire is using it as fuel for the weapon.
The planet killer.
She sounded more sardonic than she felt.
You don't think it's real?
Jin shrugged and passed back the quadnocks.
Could be. Your boss was right when she said it seems like the sort of thing the Empire would do.
The natural culmination of everything the Emperor has done.
Cassian corrected. His lips curled in a wry smile.
Either way, it's not surprising the Empire wants a planet killer. It'd just be surprising if it works.
The droid spoke cheerfully.
It might not. Not much crystal left at this point.
Jin glanced at K2 and found herself eyeing his imperial markings.
Maybe we should leave target practice here behind.
Are you talking about me?
The droid asked. Cassian straightened and tugged his jacket tighter as the wind picked up.
She's right, he said. We need to blend in. Stay with the ship.
I can blend in.
K2SO returned. It wasn't so much a protest as a declaration. Jin snorted.
With Saw's forces? Or the Imperials? Half the people here want to reprogram you. The other half want to put a hole in your head.
I'm surprised you're so concerned with my safety.
Jin turned back to the city and the valley, trying to guess at the distance they'd need to cover.
You overpacked, she decided, and tossed her satchel to K2SO.
I'm not concerned, she said. I'm just worried our enemies might miss you and hit me. Cassian had already started walking. Jin followed. When the droid called,
Doesn't sound so bad to me.
She pretended not to hear.
Bodhi Rook couldn't see the creature in the cave. When he craned his neck, tried to squirm out of his bonds or pull himself away from the chair, the shadows of the cave seemed to crawl, wriggling, like the ocean creatures he'd seen in an aquarium as a child. The shadows writhed and played in long wisps and blunt stubs. But when he tried to focus on them, to bring a single tendril into view out of the dark, he saw nothing. No motion but the flicker of lanterns in his peripheral vision.
Poor Gullet can feel your thoughts, said the ghost.
Saw Gerrera was watching. He was outside the cave, the cell that contained Bodhi and the creature. Safe, but watching.
Don't do this.
Bodhi said, barely loud enough to hear.
Don't do this, please.
He mumbled things, incoherent things, pleading things, because it was all he knew how to do.
The sores on his feet, the chill in his fingers, the dehydration and bruises, these were discomforts he could survive. They were discomforts he understood. He'd suffered before. Gone through sleep deprivation during pilot training. He was afraid of pain, yes, but the thing in the shadows repelled him, offended him on a level too intimate for words.
No lie is safe, Saw Gerrera said.
The shadows were crawling toward Bodhi now, swirling around the base of his chair. They smelled cloying as blooming flowers. He held his breath, tried to shrink back into his seat.
What have you really brought me, cargo pilot? Borg Gullet will know the truth.
Bodhi felt a touch on his shoulders, on his neck, feather light and almost gentle. When he trembled, however, the touch became painful, like his flesh was being pinched in a vice. He thought he was saying, "I never lied to you, I never lied!" But he couldn't hear his voice. The tendrils found his forehead. He felt his hair pressed tight against his skull as something wrapped about him. He closed his eyes. His body felt cold and clammy with sweat. He was too dehydrated to exude, and pinpricks of fire burned at his temples. These are a few of the things that Bodhi saw. His mother, her hands over his own, showing him how to cut a vegetable stalk with a knife in the family kitchen. His mother never let Bodhi handle knives, but this time was different because she felt sorry for him, and he couldn't recall why. He was certain the reason would break his heart. There was something he had lost. He would have wept if he had not begun to see. Miserno, his teacher, his co-pilot on the Fenterson run, who would while away the journey talking about his years shooting pirates and rebels and separatist holdouts in a starfighter, whose breath stank and who joked loudly about how badly he treated cadets, but who drunkenly called Bodhi his best friend, his only friend. Galen Erso, who looked not entirely unlike Miserno, telling Bodhi, "There is nothing brave about blind obedience. The simplest droid does what it's told. Never questioning or deciding. If you want to know what we're building, Bodhi Rook, you could simply ask." And he hadn't asked. Not then. Not yet. His cargo shuttle in flames, his hands burning as he worked the controls, trying to gain altitude, to keep out of the streams of particle bolts from the ground as the rebel shot at him. Someone was screaming in the aft compartment, but he couldn't do anything. Just fly. Just hope the stormtroopers or the TIE fighters would intervene. Bodhi wasn't sure if these things had happened at all. He could no longer remember how to breathe and felt the strain in his lungs. "The unfortunate side effect," the ghost voice of Saw Gerrera said, "is that one tends to lose one's mind." From a distance, the city had seemed as silent as the desert, its desolation broken only by the rumble of starships like wind. But up close, the streets were awash with the sounds of daily life in Jeddah, the shuffle of foot traffic and the shouts and clatter of merchants, the monotone chanting of pilgrims and the hum of machinery. Threaded among these noises were the sounds of occupation. Distorted voices of stormtroopers demanding scan docks at checkpoints, the roar of uncontrolled fires in contested sectors, and the echo of distant sporadic blaster volleys. Jin knew the sounds of occupation well. They were the sounds of home.
"We've got a good few hours of daylight left," Cassian said.
Jin followed him through a curtain and into a pockmarked alley-turned living room for a colony of Kubas. The two ignored the long-snouted aliens and picked their way around blankets and sizzling cookpots as they walked.
"We'll probably need them. There's a curfew at sunset, and I don't fancy a walk back through the desert after dark."
"No sightseeing, then?"
"No sightseeing."
As they turned a corner and exited a second curtain, they passed into a tightly packed crowd constrained by a narrow street. Jin brushed against a passerby, then felt a jolt as someone shoved her to one side. Her hand went under her jacket, sought her truncheon as her assailant snarled,
"You better watch yourself!"
Spoiling for a fight. Her gaze caught the man's face, a barely human mien distorted from burns or scarring, and moved to a second individual, aquilish, all tusks and bulbous black eyes behind him. She could take them both. Her heart was suddenly racing. She smiled coldly.
"No, no."
Cassian grasped her arm, tugged her back into the flow of the crowd.
"We don't want any trouble. Sorry."
The surge of adrenaline left her. Without a distraction at hand, her mind returned, unprompted,
to an image of her father's face. A face nearly 15 years out of date, but still the face of the man who'd abandoned her to serve the Empire. She kicked at the dust, shook her head when Cassian started to speak. "So what now?" she asked. If he noticed her discomfort, he didn't show it.
"Good for him," she thought. "I had a contact," he said. "One of Saw's rebels, but he's just gone missing. His sister will be looking for him."
"Sweet family. The temple's been destroyed, but she'll be there waiting. There are enough pilgrims around to make it a decent place to hide in plain sight. Use as a dead drop. We'll give her your name and the hope that gets us a meeting with Saw."
"Hope?" She eyed Cassian dubiously. "Is that the best rebel intelligence can do?"
Cassian might as well have shrugged.
"Rebellions are built on hope," he said.
The crowd thinned out one street over. Jin drew up her hood as they passed a squad of stormtroopers knocking on doors and manhandling residents. She didn't reach for a weapon this time. She'd be too tempted to use it. She tuned out the pleas of the Jedha citizens instead and zeroed in on the words of an Imperial propaganda hologram shimmering nearby. Something about an armed fugitive in a stolen Imperial flight suit. She waited until they were out of earshot of the troopers, and then asked, "Is this all because of your pilot?" Cassian didn't bother answering the question.
"Wait for me," he said,
and disappeared into the crush of bodies. Jin grunted an assent and began a slow orbit of a tight cluster of merchant stalls. She made a show of turning her head to study the contents of the shops. Hand-knit fabrics, fruit so brown and spotted that it had to have been grown locally. Shards of stone ostensibly from ruined shrines within the wastelands, and avoided eye contact with the hawkers. She could still hear the propaganda hologram in the distance.
"Goes by the name Bodhi Rook."
But a pilgrim's chanting rose in volume until it drowned out almost everything else. Over and over, a simple refrain.
"May the force of others be with you."
She picked up a palm-sized heater that a merchant promptly slapped from her hand. Her mind began to drift, and she feared she'd start thinking of Saw again, of Galen Erso. Yet the chant resounded inside her skull. It followed her as she walked, until she was sure that the pilgrim responsible had fallen in behind her. She snapped a glance over her shoulder. The chant ended. At Jin's back was an ancient woman with withered hands, currently haggling over the heater Jin had set down. Not her chanter.
"Would you trade that necklace for a glimpse into your future?"
The voice of the pilgrim. Jin frowned and took another step forward, trying to locate the source.
"Yes, I'm speaking to you."
Without the monotone sobriety of the chant, the voice seemed touched with gentle humor. She found the speaker at last, seated on the ground a few steps down the line of stalls. He was dressed simply in a dark shirt and charcoal robe in the local style, and his smooth skin fought gamely against the years that infected his words. His eyes were milky and unfocused, and at his side lay a sturdy wooden staff in the dust.
"Are there trees left on Jedha?" Jin wondered. "Your necklace?"
the man repeated. Jin felt the crystal against her skin. Her necklace was still hidden, buried under layers of cloth, and the man was blind.
"I am Chirrut Imwe," the man said.
"How did you know I was wearing a necklace?"
Jin asked, and felt like a fool, like a mark. Even as she spoke, Chirrut's next words only confirmed her instinct.
"For that answer, you must pay."
It was the reply of a con artist. Jin shook her attention from Chirrut to search for his partner. He must have had a partner, one who had spotted her necklace somehow, and immediately found her quarry. A hulk of a man with hair as wild as Chirrut's was neat, in a filthy civilian flight suit and battered red plastoid armor half concealed under a wearable tarp.
On his back was a generator unit connected to the blaster cannon he held casually in one hand. He stood with the stoic confidence of a bodyguard, unafraid of thieves or stormtroopers.
How did you know I was wearing a necklace?
Jin asked the second man, who shook his head slowly and snorted. Under other circumstances, she might have admired his weapon. Now she didn't want to give him the satisfaction.
What do you know of Kyber crystals?
Chirrut asked. His tone was patient, prompting. She should have turned away, refused to be lured in. Yet Chirrut's voice seemed to resonate like his chant and demand an answer. My father, she eventually said, and it tasted less bitter than she expected. He said they powered the Jedi lightsabers.
Chirrut nodded approvingly.
Jin half-parted her lips, tried to speak before the blind man's voice could enter her skull again. But another sound broke the spell instead.
Jin!
Cassian, sharp and low.
Come on!
She wrenched away from Chirrut, took three strides at Cassian's side before the pilgrim's next words found her.
The strongest stars have hearts of Kyber.
Her necklace seemed to burn in the cold.
Let's go,
Cassian urged. She couldn't help glancing back once at the pilgrim, or the con man, and his partner. But she shrugged off Cassian's guiding hand and trailed him willingly down the street.
We're not here to make friends, he muttered. Not with those guys.
Who are they?
The Guardians of the Wheels,
protectors of the Temple of the Kyber.
But there's nothing left to protect, so now they're just causing trouble for everybody.
She frowned. What kind of trouble? Cassian turned his head in a slow arc as if checking for pursuit.
For the Guardians. Anyone who's not a pilgrim is intruding on holy ground. The Empire calls them strays. Used to be domesticated, still beg for scraps, but they've really gone feral. Look at them wrong, and they'll bite your hand in a second.
You'll make me like them, Jin said. She tried to push their faces, Chirrut's voice out of her brain. They probably were con men, even if they'd been zealots once. Beyond that, she didn't know enough about the local religions to speculate. Pilgrims from 100 faiths came to the moon from across the galaxy, and all of them blurred together into the same pathetic cult, chanting and moaning and squirming under the Empire's boot. Cassian didn't reply. His pace picked up.
You seem awfully tense all of a sudden, she said. What were you doing back there?
Spotted an old associate. He didn't have any better line on Sol Guerrera. But he's been hearing rumors.
What kind of rumors? They were drawing closer to the Holy Quarter, and the character of the streets was changing. The roads grew wider, just as ancient, but no longer touched by the centuries of expansion, of the layering of building onto building by residents and merchants. The vendors and their customers were fewer, replaced by pilgrims in bright red caftans and hoods and shawls.
"They search for the pilot," Cassian said. "The door-to-door inspections. There were shootings last night. An elderly couple dead in their home. Other civilians rounded up. No one's sure if they were innocent or if they knew something about the defector. But word is out that Sol Guerrera is planning reprisals.
That doesn't sound like Sol, Jin said. Cassian threw her a skeptical look, and she hastily explained.
Not that he wouldn't arrange revenge attacks, but if he were that easily baited, they'd have caught him long ago.
Cassian frowned in thought and seemed to process the words.
Could be my associate was wrong, he said. Could be it's one of Saw's people arranging the attack without oversight from Saw himself. Or it could be Saw thinks the Empire is vulnerable right now, distracted by the search or something else we don't know about. Regardless, we have to hurry. This town, it's ready to blow.
They passed a mural. Colors long since faded to muddy indecipherability. Jin saw chips in the stone and a grenade fragment lodged into the wall. She laughed gutturally.
"We're a little late for that," she said, though she didn't slow her stride.
They arrived on an upper-level street overlooking a large plaza. The shadow of a descending Imperial cargo shuttle spread over the ground while a squad of stormtroopers rousted sleeping forms out of doorways and shoved them headlong into neighboring streets, waved blaster rifles at pilgrims, and barked orders. Jin was surprised by the aggression. At close quarters, one squad couldn't suppress a riot until she saw the assault tank rumbling around a corner to join the Imperial forces. Its blaster cannons could have leveled a city block. Jin didn't doubt its pilots were eager for a challenge. Secured to the back of the tank were the same orange cargo crates she'd seen while spying on the city from afar. The Kyber crystals, mined from the ground or stolen from holy sites. "The strongest stars have hearts of Kyber." She indicated the crates to Cassian with a nod. His attention was elsewhere. He was scanning the rooftops, his gaze flickering back periodically to the civilians lined up along the edge of the plaza. To a person, the onlookers were garbed in thick, bulky cloaks and overcoats. When Jin recognized what was happening, she was surprised the stormtroopers hadn't already opened fire. But the Imperials appeared entirely, almost pitiably, oblivious.
"How far is your contact? The sister of Saw's man?"
she asked, barely louder than a breath.
"Half a dozen blocks over," Cassian murmured. "But I don't think she's going to stick around."
A wrinkled Duros scampered up the stairs from the lower level and past Jin and Cassian, red beetle eyes avoiding the now grounded shuttle, the tank, and every living creature nearby.
"Tell me you have a backup plan," Jin said. "You want to tap one of these guys on the shoulder, ask if they can spare some advice before the shooting starts?"
"We've got to get out of here."
Cassian spoke the words like a curse. Jin didn't see who threw the first grenade. She heard it strike pavement despite the noise of the vehicles, recognized the sound despite the murmuring from the rooftops and the sharp commands of the stormtroopers. A glint of sunlight drew her eye to the metal sphere, and she saw it bounce once, roll half a meter in the direction of the tank, then disappear in an eruption of street fragments and smoke and shrapnel. She felt the resonant boom in her teeth. She heard a dozen cloaks and overcoats being shucked in unison, then the dull clack of pistols and rifles being brought to bear. The air turned bright with the arterial glow of 100 particle bolts. Sparks burst off ancient stone walls. The noxious smell of burning plastoid armor and the ozone of vaporized Jedha atmosphere stung Jin's nostrils. A volley of blaster fire coursed across the plaza's upper level, originating from stormtrooper or insurgent, Jin wasn't sure. And Jin reacted instinctively, dashing with Cassian into the flimsy shelter of a doorframe and squeezing tight against him.
"Looks like we found Saw's rebels," she said.
Her blaster was in her hand. Her finger was on the trigger. If Cassian replied, Jin lost the words in the bedlam. She tried to read the battlefield, pinpoint every combatant, and found the chaos overwhelming. This wasn't her kind of fight anymore. There were too many people on each side deploying tactics she hadn't thought about in too long. All of Saw's training, the long months staring at holographic carnage, and the years of staging ambushes with his soldiers churned wildly in her brain. She spied only moments. A stormtrooper shot in the visor while swapping blaster packs. A rebel bleeding on the stairs and desperately searching for cover. The guns of the tank elevating, aiming toward a shop whose rooftop supported a trio of rebel attackers. Beneath the awning of the shop stood a girl, 10 years old at the most. Probably a pilgrim, Jin thought. The girl was trembling, staring at the battle, utterly paralyzed. Jin left the cover of the doorway and ran for the shop. Cassian called her name, but it meant nothing. Jin didn't see the tank open fire. She grabbed the girl, scooped up her two-light body, and didn't stop running as stone burst and sparks spattered her back like rain. Fury drove her forward. A sudden revulsion that had lain buried and forgotten under the hatch in her brain. A violent horror at Saw Gerrera and his people, and the cost of his tactics. Jin might have kicked the woman who stepped forward to intercept her if the girl she carried hadn't writhed and twisted, almost leapt into the woman's outstretched arms. Jin let the girl go, ignored the woman's babbling, and waved her off.
You cluster together, you die, she thought.
The old training was resurfacing after all. She was too exposed. She knew that. She searched the plaza for cover and for Cassian. She spotted him out of the shelter of the doorframe, stupidly, dangerously near the tank, and realized he'd already seen her. He had his own blaster out and fired a cluster of tight shots above her head. She craned her neck around in time to see Cassian's target, a rebel stationed on another rooftop behind her. An instant later, Cassian's target and his rebel comrades disappeared in the fiery bloom of a grenade. Jin could only guess one of the rebels had been aiming the explosive her way. Cassian had shot one of Saw's rebels to save her life. Jin supposed she should have been anguished, torn at the thought. She wasn't. She sprinted toward Cassian. Clustering would get them killed, but she didn't plan on staying in the plaza, and she didn't relish the thought of escaping Jedha on her own. She bowled into Cassian as another grenade impacted the tank. She slammed him to the ground and shielded him as metal shredded the air. Cassian dragged her to her feet and uttered a breathless, "Come on!" He didn't thank her, and Jin was grateful for it. They made it 15 meters from the plaza before hitting another stormtrooper squad. Half a dozen soldiers obstructed the alley Jin and Cassian had turned down, advancing gingerly through the holy quarter like they expected the streets to be mined. Jin swore to herself. Cassian pivoted around, but the stormtroopers reacted faster, turning their rifles on the man. One might miss. Together they'd cut him down in seconds. Jin called Cassian's name and barreled forward, pulling her truncheons from her coat. The fight in the plaza had numbed her senses. Her body had acclimated to the roar of explosions, the glare of particle bolts, the heat of flames, and the blasts of demolished stone across her face. The brief respite from combat had let her feel again, and now her cheeks prickled and her legs throbbed with fatigue. She gripped her truncheons too tight, afraid she'd lose one as she slammed the metal rods into the joints of stormtrooper armor. She targeted throats and behind knees, felt the cushion of bodysuits underneath the trooper's plating, and struck again, again, crushing her own fingernails bloody in the pressure of her grasp. She knocked aside rifles with her shoulders, wedged herself into the fray to deny her opponents the opportunity to aim. She let her strikes determine her balance, moved from blow to blow, and ignored the flat smack of a rifle butt against her ribcage. When her truncheon found air, when no foe stood within reach, she stumbled back against the alley wall and exchanged a truncheon for a blaster. She fired two shots, dispatched two more troopers bringing their weapons to bear on her. She kicked one of the men she'd left on the ground and turned in time to see Cassian execute their last upright opponent. She was ready to drop from exhaustion. The blow to her ribs made her want to vomit. But she saw a long, spindly shadow extend down the length of the alley and forced herself to turn. In the stormtrooper's wake came the black metal body of an Imperial security droid, marching on thin, titanium-strong legs. She dropped her second truncheon, gripped her blaster in both hands, and felt her aim waver as she fired. Despite her unsteady hands, the shot hit its mark. The droid's chest sparked, and something internal popped. It tumbled to the ground, only to reveal a second identical droid marching behind it. The second droid shuffled to a halt. The heat of the blaster barrel warmed Jin's cold fingers. She took aim. The second droid bent his head to study his fallen comrade.
"Did you know that wasn't me?"
Jin furiously searched her memory and recognized the voice of K2SO.
"Of course," she snapped.
Cassian joined them as she tucked away her blaster and recovered her truncheon.
"I thought I told you to stay with the ship," he growled.
"You did," K2SO replied. "But I thought it was boring, and you were in trouble. There are a lot of explosions for two people blending in."
A series of short resonant blasts echoed from the direction of the plaza. A new column of smoke, threads of blue mixed in with the black, wafted above the rooftops. Another assault tank? Jin wondered. Maybe a walker?
"We could find one of Saw's people," Cassian said.
Jin noticed he was sweating despite the cold, despite his matter-of-fact tone.
"Preferably someone down but still breathing. Maybe he could help us."
"If you want to drag someone out of that death trap,"
Jin jutted a thumb toward the plaza,
"you're welcome to try. But I'm guessing the rebels here aren't feeling trusting right now."
"Just keep an eye out," Cassian said.
K2SO turned his head. Jin couldn't tell if he was listening to something, concentrating on whatever sorts of frequencies an Imperial security droid might pick up, or looking at Cassian askance.
"The Imperial forces are converging on our present location,"
K2SO said. The droid's head jerked again, and Jin followed the machine's gaze to the stormtroopers left sprawled on the ground. One trooper had risen to a knee, a small metallic cylinder in his left hand. He threw the grenade limply. Before Jin could move, as she tensed to leap away, K2 extended an inhumanly long arm and caught the cylinder in one hand. A moment later, the grenade retraced its arc perfectly. Jin winced and turned away from the explosion.
A cold voice inside her said, "No more witnesses."
"I suggest we leave immediately,"
K2 declared, and they left. For the first time since crossing the desert to the Holy City, Cassian noticed the cold. The insulating press of bodies in the street had kept him warm much of the day. Then, during the fighting, the chill hadn't registered at all. Now that sunset was approaching and his undershirt was soaked with sweat, he found himself shivering and watching his breath steam from his lips. If it was this bad for him, he couldn't imagine how Jin was still standing. The need in her eyes had been subsumed by an almost feral anger, a survival instinct that guided her with frightening surety through the chaos. But while he didn't doubt her alertness, she was slowing physically. The bruises she'd sustained brawling with the stormtroopers left her wincing with every other step. Cassian wondered, too, if she'd been concussed when she'd saved his life in the plaza. The grenade had gone off with stunning force, and she'd shielded him from the brunt of the blow. She needed a medical droid, a chance to recuperate. Instead, she traveled with Cassian and K2 through the maze of the Holy Quarter, her head low and her breathing strained.
"We'll find shelter soon," he said.
He kept his eyes averted and his tone matter-of-fact. He doubted she would respond well to pity. Even so, she didn't argue. That struck Cassian as a bad sign. He tried to focus on practicalities. They had to escape the Holy Quarter before it was cordoned off. They would need to reach Saw Gerrera and the pilot without the help of Cassian's contact. And while Jin was right that Saw's people wouldn't be trusting right now, Cassian couldn't see any other leads. Could Saw Gerrera put aside bad blood in the face of a planet killer? It seemed madness to have to ask. But by all accounts, the rift between Saw and the Alliance was profound, nurtured by years of bitterness that had curdled into violence. and saw Guerrera was not a man who knew how to forgive. He'd passed that on to his adopted daughter, or maybe she'd taught it to him. Jin blocked Cassian's path with an outstretched arm.